So say if you called someplace long distance today, you'd expect it to be on your next bill for, you know, this billing cycle or whatever. Well, you'd get like a bill, like say in July or something, including this call.
Yeah,
that would catch a lot of customers by surprise, and you know, they'd, you know,
had to
all
deal
of a sudden,
that.
They'd go from like a $30 bill to like a $200 bill because of these calls adding up onto one.
Uh-huh.
That screwed a lot of people over, and we weren't allowed to talk about it, like, to the customer unless they noticed it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I had a real moral objection to that, so I would just fix customers' accounts if I saw any problems with them. Well, when you're working customer service, the whole like, idea is just to get as many calls as you can and, you know, to pitch a sale to the customer.
Uh-huh.
And so, to the supervisors, I was wasting time with that. And almost lost my job a couple times doing that. And anyway, I read a nice little pseudo article about it, I guess.
I think there's a local thing going on here in Tampa, or with just Verizon in general in Florida. They were actually charging people for long distance calls they didn't make. And I read about it in the newspaper, and charges ranged from $25 to $30 to like $100. Of missed charges because of some glitch or something. And a lot of people didn't catch it. But they wouldn't go out and actually tell you. It's when you caught it and came and complained that they changed it. They wouldn't just change it on their own.
Yeah, it's exactly how it works. Basically,
right.
the representatives would say, well, we were told to say, like, that they're, you know, if they asked how their account was, we would tell them, oh, everything was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if the customer saw some sort of problem, and that's when we had to acknowledge it. We weren't supposed to bring up billing problems with the customer unless they saw.
It's kind of a shady thing.
Because their motto was, it's not our fault if they don't pay attention to their bill. Well, I mean, I'm sure legally, you know, it's MCI that should be paying attention to what they're charging the customer and not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have that on my Dish Network bill. We would order, like, pay-per-view movies. And we'd ordered a whole lot, and we were wondering, well, why aren't these on our bill? And then all of a sudden, one month, there was like $150 in pay-per-views from the day that we got it till then.
For some people, that's not great. I mean, for some people, it doesn't matter. I mean, they can pay it whenever the bill comes in. But for some people, they want to be able to pay the little $30 a month, and they can't afford a $200 bill 1 month. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's
like people who are on a budget, you know, they budget for that certain amount
each month.
And then they get like a less, you know, a lesser bill. They're like, okay, this is nice.
Yeah.
But when they get the rest of that remaining bill on their next month's bill, they're not ready for that. This is fitting to their budget. So.
Is there anything that, like, any kind of contract, like, it would get rid of it if you didn't pay it? Could they complain, like, why is this on my bill this month? I'm not paying this much. Is there any way they could not pay it and still keep their contract?
If the customer, like, complained enough and the call started to get escalated, you know, to the point where they asked for a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And basically how they told us to do it was to avoid that step, to go ahead and issue them a one-time credit, you know, telling them that, okay, next month you should pay more attention to your bill, but this month we'll cover you, and we're sorry for the inconvenience.
Oh.
Just to avoid getting a supervisor on the phone because working in that environment, the supervisors don't want to take calls because all they do is just sit back at their desk and listen to the reps take calls and just evaluate them, and they
mm-hmm.
just push sales. That's all they're there for. And the supervisor doesn't necessarily know more about the accounts and how the systems work than the representatives do. Sometimes they're brought in from other departments just because they've been there, they have 10 years, so they can get a supervisor position. And I had a supervisor that was just a complete dumbass. He didn't even know how to double-click a mouse, let alone check your account to see, you know, if there's any problems.
So. Uh-huh. So they'd bring in supervisors from totally different places of the company.
Yeah, they'd be like, supervisor that got transferred from advertising to
mm-hmm.
Customer service, you know?
Right.
And two different departments, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, they had tenure. And,
that's
you know,
terrible. I don't see why they thought that happened. Oh, well. That's kind of weird. Yeah, I was just wondering, like, if they complained about it enough, they'd let it slide, or they would just either terminate their contract, or what would happen?
Well,
their response was,
like, if the customer couldn't pay it, they would turn off their service.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And the bad thing was, for a lot of the areas, people had MCI for local service. I think at the time it was, I think it was Michigan, Illinois, Texas, and Georgia that we had local service with at the time,
yeah.
where MCI offered local service. And lots of people, they had MCI for local and long distance. And if they had their long distance carryover, if they couldn't afford to pay that, MCI would just connect their local and long distance service. They wouldn't have either.
That's, in my personal opinion, it's wrong because, like I said before, someone with a monthly budget cannot afford to pay it and they just turn off your phone. So, I mean, phone service for that. But you said that they credit the account?
Yeah, if you got to the point where you want to speak to a supervisor,
uh-huh.
and you work, it's actually, working in that environment, it's better to not get irate. Just be, stay calm and, you know, don't get mad at the customer service representative. Like, they'll start to take it personally, and they won't want to give you what you want.
Yeah. Did you hear that Ben Rev episode with the guy that wanted his new mouse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, and I would have just hung up on that guy.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're not supposed to hang up on the customer.
Right.
That's one of them. You have to, like, warn them a couple times, usually, like I can't speak with you if you're going to be irate like that.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to have to disconnect this call. You know,
right.
Say things like that.
You never know
when your supervisor is listening because they can listen on your line silently. They don't have to be in the building sometimes.
So that there's a remote number that they can call into and
yeah, they can call in remotely and then they can pick your terminal and they can listen to your call anywhere.
Interesting.
That sounds like a number that I'd like to get a hold of.
Yeah. Also, another interesting thing I noticed when I was working at MCI that all the supervisors have AIM running on their system.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they use to communicate with supervisors around the building.
Huh.
And I told my supervisor's AIM one day and wrote it down, and I couldn't have access to it from the outside. So either they have it set up where only other supervisors can see if they're online, or they have their own internal AIM.
Yeah, some local service thing.
I know that AOL does offer like some sort of enterprise AIM for corporate use server, so.
Really?
So either they have that or they're using...
Do they still have the advertisements?
That, I don't remember that. If they had the advertisements, I would assume that it was probably just the general AIM service.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that the corporate one doesn't have advertisements.
Yeah, if you pay for it, I assume they don't force you to watch the newest movie trailers.
But, you know, if you could, you know, instant message... Oh, they had, like... Their screen names were like MCI, and then their last name followed by the first initial, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
So, if they did have access to the outside, you could easily local engineer somebody over AIM and send you another customer service or like another customer service supervisor someplace else.
Uh-huh.
Well, didn't you have a meeting that you had to go to not get social engineered, like training?
Yeah, that was one thing that we went to was that they even referred to it as social engineering. They said it's commonly known as social engineering.
Yeah.
We had a meeting with my department. They had all the representatives get off the phone for like an hour, which was fine with me because I didn't want to be on the phone anyway. They basically went over like hypothetical situations where somebody would be calling in and pretending to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it, like flags that will come up that you have to watch for and things like that.
I actually have like a poster from, a government company or agency, but it's a social engineering calendar. It's a calendar, and on the little side of the calendar has, like, beware of social engineering, and it has percentages for all the different ways of, like, the biggest majority of social engineering is actually from someone walking up to you trying to acquisition of goods or whatever, saying that there's somebody. And the majority of that goes on the internet is extremely low. It's, like, below 5%. And telephone is, like, low, too, but the majority of it is actually from person-to-person meeting.
The world's greatest social engineers are girls, though. For the face-to-face, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's completely true if you think about it. So,
so is that it for MCI?
Oh, there's another thing I wanted to bring up,
okay.
Is that the MCI calling card that they really try to push us onto the customers that were order service, and I noticed that, like, the majority of the customers don't know how those work. Like, they assume that, okay, I'm at my friend's house or I'm at this payphone, so I can use this MCI calling card and get the same long-distance rates that I have on my home phone.
Right.
That's what they assume, and the paperwork makes it seem like get raped with the charges.
Yeah.
There'd be customers that have, like, I was literally seeing $3,000 phone bills due to these calling cards. And the people were just, you know, shocked that they're, you know, that they're having these problems. Like, you know, they didn't expect to pay that, but looking over the, you know, looking over their bill, all the calls were, you know, from payphones or,
they charge, I think AT&T does also, they charge, like, say you buy a 100-minute phone card, they charge 7 minutes just for connecting the call from a payphone.
That's
terrible. There's also a lot of problems. I know, like, in the Chicago area, we went into a lot where people were having their calling cards just stolen out of their mailbox for some of their people.
Mm-hmm. Calling cards are a good way to lose money.
Yeah. And it was very hard for a customer to get, like, a $3,000 credit on their bill.
Right.
You know, so I mean, you could maybe do that one time, but when customer service representatives have to issue a credit, mm-hmm. it's not coming from them. So when they tell you, oh, I've issued a credit, you still might not get that because they have to send that credit to, like, another department.
And they decide.
Yeah, and then they decide. So you want to call in and double-check those things. Or, I mean, also, every time you call, there's something noted in your account. And even when people call and pretend to be you, like someone tries to social engineer their way into the account, mm-hmm. we don't let them in. We don't tell them anything from them. But afterwards, we will note in the account that someone was trying to have access to it. So it's also a good idea to have your account password protected. You just tell them that, and then you'll have like some sort of passphrase.
All right.
That's good. That is if they prompt you for a password.
Yeah, they'll ask you what your password is. And if you don't get it, you can't get in.
What's some of the most dumb passphrases that you've heard?
I had people tell us, like, oh, just use secret. Or just use my last name.
Right.
You know, and you have to tell them, well, that's probably not the most secure password for your account.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to have to remember anything else.
But still, most people are thinking, like, their dog's names or their kids' names or something
right.
like that.
Well, it's still more secure than, say, Secret. You'd have to have some background info on them to get something like that.
Yeah, Secret, Secret, yeah. God.
Because, like, if I was calling in trying to get access to somebody's account, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I would try Secret just because I didn't think anybody would be that stupid to do it, you know? It's like when you have to tell somebody that you want your password to be secret.
Leave your voicemail box on default because everyone would assume that you're smarter than that.
Actually, whenever I got this cell phone, for our vacation, speaking of things on default, I don't want to get off track or anything, but I called up the number from my home phone to see if it worked, and it wasn't activated yet, and it just prompted me to go ahead and fill out all the stuff for voicemail from my landline.
Right.
It said, go ahead and enter your password, and I entered the password I was going to use, and it said, thank you, and go ahead and say your greeting.
Yeah.
It didn't have any password on it already.
Yeah,
it didn't even ring because the phone wasn't activated, but the number was, so
right.
It just went straight to voicemail. That was kind of scary. Oh, well. All right, back on topic.
That's pretty much all I had to say about MCI.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend working there. I quit before all their problems were done with reporting the false profits. So.
Oh, it was WorldCom.
Verizon had some of those problems, too, locally here.
In the call center I worked at, I think they closed my off everybody when that all happened. So.
Well,
and it was such a shitty building too. It was so run down. And, I mean, it was in a really bad area of town, and it was a lot of people who were working there. That you know, there's people that sat by me that worked there because they were in a halfway house and they had to have a job, and the
uh-huh.
people that was higher than. I mean, and that was like I was only doing it because it worked with my school like schedule.
Right.
It didn't pay very well. They have a lot of signs there that say, leave work here. Don't take it with you because you have a lot of customers that feel so bad.
Uh-huh.
Even though they're calling you, it's not like telemarketing or anything. It wears on you after a while.
Right.
Well, speaking of being in bad parts of town and I'm assuming easy dumpster access, weren't you going to talk about dumpster diving and DirecTV?
Yeah, those two actually link together pretty well for me. Probably back in about 98 or 99, I started getting into the whole DirecTV hacking thing.
Right.
Only because my parents had a huge bill due to that whole, like, pay-per-view rollover that they couldn't afford to pay at the time. So
uh-huh.
service was turned off for a couple months, and I wanted my DirecTV. I was missing my TV. So, like, I never really thought about the whole hacking of DirecTV, and I just like, just did a, like, a search online just blindly and actually, like, realized that there was a whole scene for that going on at the time. And so I read up on it and found out, like, what all had to be done and, you know, got to know my equipment, what I had, and what could be done with that equipment. At the time, I had, well, the way DirecTV works is that you have the receiver and you have, like, a smart card in the receiver. And I think now they don't use the smart card. You can pull out. I think it's somehow built into the system.
It might be some kind of, like, firmware update or something.
Yeah, I think they changed it. Like I said, it's been since about 2001 since I've been in it.
I remember actually being able to, like, take a smart card over to your friend's house and, like, get full access.
See, back when I was doing it, you couldn't do that because the card was called, what was called married to the machine.
Uh-huh.
I sent it, it was stuck in the machine. It basically would read that machine serial number and associate it with that card, so it could only be used in that machine
uh-huh.
or that receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I ordered a smart card programmer at the time to rewrite I had an H card,
uh-huh.
and that was the little blue card that just had the satellite like symbol on it.
And a little close thing.
Yeah, and before that they had a card called the F card. I didn't have one of those until later. By the time I got one, they weren't being used anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then after the H card was the HU card, mm-hmm. and that had the football player on the front of the card. And then when I was getting out of the whole scene, there was a new card that was out. I think they were calling it the P4. I'm not sure if that's been hacked yet or not.
Well, how long was it? Did this, like, stay underground?
Well, I remember, like, it was pretty big in Canada. Like, most of the people who read on the sites were in Canada because you couldn't get DirecTV service in Canada, but the signal was reaching there.
Right.
So the whole DirecTV hacking was really big there because there was really no legal thing DirecTV could do to you because
you're not in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think the Canadian court said that it was impossible to steal something that wasn't physical
uh-huh.
or something like that. Or you couldn't steal air, basically.
Yeah, it's anything that's going over public airways is public.
And since they didn't have any, they weren't a business in Canada, you know, their service had no value.
Mm-hmm.
But people were, you know, getting DirecTV service there in Canada, which I have some friends that live in Canada, and they really enjoyed it at the time because some places in Canada, you can't get crap for TV. I mean, you have to get whatever you can get over the air, and even that's usually bad.
Right.
Unless you live in a large city in Canada. And I remember that it started becoming, like, lots of kiddies got into it after Tech TV ran a special. I think it was a show called, like, Cybercrime or something like that,
mm-hmm.
where they showed, you know, the evil hackers getting the free DirecTV. And they basically talked about how it's done and how people order the, you know, the equipment off the internet. And I remember after that, that special ran, like, there were so many people that were in it, and they weren't in it anymore for the hobby. They were in it for the free porn. And then that scene just kind of, people started becoming more secretive, and if they were making scripts for their system to have free TV, they weren't making it public, so it became a lot more private.
Right.
And the scripts that were made private, the rewrite your card, those would be the ones that were killed by DirecTV the fastest because, you know, they were public, so.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, is there anything secret that you could get that wasn't, like, public knowledge, like free ESPN and free porn? Is there anything else?
There were some corporate channels, I remember. Like, some of them were, I think there was, an internal DirecTV channel. And
right.
there are some companies that would, I think they would pay DirecTV to carry their, I don't know if you want to call it, like, corporate propaganda or whatever, but it'd be, like, meetings from various companies that they'd have on these channels that, I'm sure other authorized receivers that those companies could view.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember the companies, but I think they were insurance companies and some other ones too. Or Prudential, I think, was one of them.
Uh-huh.
I do remember you could see those channels existed without having a hack system, but you just couldn't view them.
So what would be on them when you view them? You said it would be like meetings and stuff?
Yeah, usually just be something boring meeting that you wouldn't really care about.
Right.
Where they'd just be talking about, you know, their profits for the quarter and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was still, you know, interesting to get those things.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else on the DirecTV network that you can find, like non-channel stuff, like inside the box through hex editing and stuff, or is it just free channels?
Well, like with the whole rewriting of the card, say if you didn't want to, the H card, you could actually have legit service, and you could basically remove pay-per-view purchases from your card. I think the program back when I used was called Basic H.
Uh-huh.
I still have it on some CDR somewhere, I bet. And it basically was a hex editor. I keep saying basically, oh, I'm sorry. So it was a hex editor that had functions already built into it to, you know, remove pay-per-view purchases.
Right.
Or
so you could actually just remove charges from your account?
Yeah, and if you didn't have your receiver plugged into the phone line, you could never dial out to tell DirecTV that you made those purchases.
Right.
So you could order your pay-per-view movies and then erase them off your card after you got to a certain limit, because it only lets you order, like, so many, like,
uh-huh,
a certain dollar amount before it would say, like, you couldn't order anymore.
Like, connect back to the phone line so we can charge your ass?
Yeah.
All right.
Was it just, like, a modem that dialed up and told how much it was?
Yeah, basically. I think that's how it works.
I wonder if there's any way you could get that number and do anything with that, if it still was active.
Well, DirecTV, I mean, they're still in service.
No, but they don't work the same way anymore.
Oh.
So
I think they still need to have a landline to dial out, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. I don't actually remember hooking my DirecTV box up to a phone line.
But it was a pretty safe hobby because your dish doesn't send anything out.
Right.
And a lot of the newbies in that whole thing were afraid that, oh, my dish is going to send some signal out.
Right.
They didn't understand how it worked. You were fine unless you plugged in your telephone line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were people who were busted, and that's kind of why I started getting out of it. People were getting busted because of purchasing equipment from companies that were raided,
uh-huh,
and then all their sales information was given to the FBI.
Right.
So you'd get busted that way because they would. Actually, had a friend that received a letter. I don't remember if it was from the FBI or not, but it basically said that they knew that they purchased this card rewriter,
uh-huh,
and that they wanted them to send it to this address because
for destruction.
Yeah, pretty much.
And did they?
Yeah, he did.
Well, that's better than getting raided.
Even though you could probably say that these smart card rewriters could be used for things other than DirecTV.
It's pretty obvious what you're doing.
Yeah. When they have, when you're buying it from a site that's dedicated to that.
What, do you have any examples of these websites that are actually still up?
I don't know if there's any that are still up, because, like I said, I've been out of that hobby for a long time.
Right.
After the show, if you happen to find any, I can put them up in the show notes.
Okay, I wouldn't I don't know, I'd be really, really cautious about where you'd buy equipment from.
Right.
You want to ask around people, like, in the scene, like, about, you know, where's a trusted place. But even then, if that place was busted or raided, you know,
all your credit card information. And
yeah, so you're better off finding somebody locally or something that has equipment that you can buy.
Yeah, off the street.
Yes, I would recommend that you venture down to your local black market.
Yeah.
It's right past the nukes, this side of the Rockefeller grenades. That's where you find your DirecTV stuff.
You'll find your local DirecTV dealer or whatever.
Well, if you'd like to get into your next hacked system, we can talk about Dreamcast emulators and Linux systems and stuff.
So, my next topic?
Yeah. Dreamcast hacking.
Yeah, the Dreamcast. I think the Dreamcast is something that every hacker should invest in because it's so much fun.
What about the Xbox? I mean, it's more fun to put Linux on a Microsoft product.
Yeah. I agree, and I'm actually going to be buying an Xbox now that the price has gone down.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm buying
mostly for sport emulation.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreamcast can do emulation, but you know, not as much as the Xbox can do, just because of the raw power of the Xbox.
Right.
Because the Dreamcast is actually like a 200 megahertz Hitachi processor.
Like
16 megs of RAM, so you're kind of limited as what you can run.
Yeah, and like sold them for like $20 on eBay. And it was like all these old ass games that the system could run. You hear about that?
No, I never heard about that. But I know that the piracy in the system exploit, so to speak, was one of the main reasons that the Dreamcast died.
Right. So,
because they went through all the security with having a special like boot method for the CD, and the CD was a proprietary thing called a GD-ROM, which I think they said was capable of holding 1 gig. But a lot of the games weren't 1 gig in size. They would still fit on a CDR.
Right.
And if not, people could, like, re-encode the audio to be, a lower...
bit rate?
Yeah, lower bit rate, so, you know, you could get that bass down to fit on to a CDR.
Yeah, well, I remember, like, seeing CDRs on eBay that contained, like, every Super Nintendo game, and you could run them on...
Yeah, you can actually easily make those yourself, too. I wouldn't recommend really Super Nintendo on Dreamcast because you're going to get a pretty low frame rate. They don't work that well.
Mm-hmm.
But NES and Game Boy work perfectly on the Dreamcast with the emulators I've played with. A good place to get Dreamcast emulators would be DCEmulation.com.
Yeah, we'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah, that's a great site. I've lurked around in their forums for a while. They know their stuff.
That's where I got into the whole Dreamcast stuff was there. And I bought a Dreamcast after they stopped making them.
Where at?
So I bought it at Best Buy because they were still selling them.
Mm-hmm.
I think I paid like $90 for it. They were like $200 and they went down like a lot if I bought one. But I see them now at I can never remember the name of the store, but what video games, et cetera, used to be. I think it's like Babbage's or something like that now. Or GameStop or something like that now.
Right. You can buy them probably at, like, the...
Yeah, I see them used there sometimes for, like, $25 or $30.
Right.
Which isn't bad, doing what you can do with them. I mean, they have a modem built in, and you can also swap that out for, a $200 or something there.
Really?
And there's a lot of things you can do with them.
Like, what do you have to go through to get a small Linux system or a BSD running on it?
Well, if you just want to play with Linux on Dreamcast and see how it works, I would first make sure you have the keyboard and the VGA adapter for.
Wait, I have a question.
Yes.
On Dreamcast, does it actually have an internal hard drive?
No, it doesn't. No.
Okay.
Basically, it turns that a 16 megabit range into a RAM disk.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I did see a mod once where somebody actually added a hard drive to it.
Uh huh.
But it required lots of soldering and a lot of
crap.
How to craft that up. I'm definitely not leaving enough to do, so.
Okay. Alright.
Forget what I was saying there. Oh. Yeah, if you want to get into the Linux on Dreamcast, you should make sure you buy the Dreamcast keyboard and get yourself a VGA adapter for it.
Because
if you're trying running Linux on the TV, you're going to notice text is getting cut off, or you won't see your current command line or whatever.
Yeah, it's very, very blurry.
Yeah, it doesn't look very good. But there's a lot of ISOs that you can get that people have already made that are preloaded with certain applications for you to play around with. I think the first one that I downloaded actually had Doom on it. And you can run Doom within Linux on the Dreamcast.
Mm-hmm.
It ran really slow, so if you want to play Doom on the Dreamcast, I'd recommend just getting the ported version somebody made. But it was still... It was still a lot of fun to play with it.
Yeah, I'm on DC Emulation right now, and they're actually selling, or Amazon is actually selling Dreamcast. Well, they're not, but they're used, and they're from $30 up.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. I mean, if anything, it's just a 200 megahertz, like, Linux box to play with.
Right.
And I built one custom Linux CD. And basically what's involved with that is you have to make sure you get all your... You have to have a Linux machine first off, like a actually Linux PC or something to build it on. So you have to download your cross-compilers and everything so you can compile for the Hitachi SH CPU or whatever it is. I forget what the numbers are. It's just the compilers to compile for that system.
Uh-huh.
So you compile your kernel, all the apps you want, everything. And I put together one that ran Apache, even though I don't have the internet for my Dreamcast, I just wanted to try to put a patch on my Dreamcast. So I'm thinking, like, how cool that'd be to run a web server for my Dreamcast.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be pretty hard to, own it because you couldn't really rewrite anything because it's all reading everything off the CDR. So.
Well,
you wouldn't really be able to get your page to face unless they're really leading to rewrite stuff in the RAM. So.
Another system that was like this, I believe it was Hairball was talking about it on Hacksaw Radio. I don't remember which episode it was, but he was talking about an Xbox system that you just, like, make a Linux distro and go out and buy an Xbox, and you just put it behind a firewall and load it up, and it would be the PC. That's 700 megahertz, and it has a hard drive, so... If you're wanting to do something, the Xbox would be the way to go for, like, an Apache server.
The Xbox is very, you have to actually have a game to, do, like, it's a buffer over, I'm not really sure, but, I've looked into it, and you actually have to have, kind of, like, USB flash drive connected to your, controller in one of those memory slots, and you, like, run up 007, and, when you want to load a game, the game that it goes to load has, like, some error overflow in it that lets things start booting off the Linux distro, and it goes off from there and takes over and then it does its thing.
Yeah, that's just how you can run Linux without having a modified system.
Right.
Which is pretty cool. I'm impressed that somebody figured that out.
Right.
I mean, that's one of those things that probably is just an accident or I don't know.
There's only two games that you can do it in. It's 007's, whatever that game is for the Xbox, I don't forget the name. But then there's also one for Mech Assault. And they do the same thing in Mech Assault. But anyway, back on Dreamcast. That's just my thing.
I don't remember which direction I was going in though.
Linux system?
Oh, I mean, under that, but,
like the Apache server.
Yeah, you can run Apache. And I know there's some people who do it. I actually went to a website once that was both supposedly running off
Dreamcast.
How big would the webpage have to be? Like 5 meg, 6 meg? How much RAM would Apache take up?
That I don't know.
Like, since it's running on RAM, like, how big could your
webpage be? I didn't have a lot of the modules installed. Like, I didn't have PHP or anything. It was basically just straight HTML. And it shouldn't matter how big your website is because you're loading out the CD and so that over.
Now you did have a telephone. It does have a modem built in it, you said.
Yeah, it does.
So,
and people have made drivers for that modem.
Uh-huh.
I haven't played with it yet.
Right.
But that could be fun to, do some mess around with the modem on the Dreamcast. The drivers are out there at open source.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'd like to see some homebrew games that actually have that, some sort of dial-up networking support or something. I don't know. Something more. Like back in the day when you wanted to play your friends in, like, Doom or Duke Nukem, you'd actually just dial them up directly and play them. Like, that'd be cool to do that with
some new custom homemade Doom.
With some console, it'd be awesome to dial somebody up and play Doom over the TV.
Right.
I would do that just for old times' sake.
Yeah.
That sounds like it'd be a fun game to play.
Yeah, it's a classic, so.
If I knew how to get into that, I'd like to see something like that happen, but too much of a noob.
So, what else did we have to talk about?
I think that's all we had on the show notes. If anybody has anything off the top.
I it's kind of like way off topic, but I actually wanted to say, how many people use LOL and never laugh? How many times are you in IRC and chat LOL or whatever and, like, not even correct file and just sit there and, like, here. A loser comment of the day.
I don't know. I use it a lot. Most of the time I don't laugh. If it's something funny, most of the time in IRC it's not that funny, but it deserves an LOL at least.
I think if I'm actually laughing, I think I type laughing my ass off instead of LOL.
Yeah.
Now, just listening to this conversation, if I step outside myself, this is pretty geeky. Oh man. All
you were trying to say that you would talk to somebody in person and say hello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the only time that I'd be cruising around the internet and I'd actually mean an LOL is if I happen to be on bash.org. That's the only time that I actually mean it, really. Some funny stuff there.
I've actually laughed a few times. But most of the time it's just like, the guy made a really lame joke. Let me put LOL to make him feel better. Alright, how long have we been going?
Yeah, judging by that silence, I think we're over.
Well, how long have we been going?
Oh, we've been going for about 40 minutes.
Alright, so...
call that that?
You guys got shout-outs? Yeah, shout-out. I don't know. Shout-out to ZeroDB for hosting our Campus Music 100 site.
Yeah, shout-outs to him. Shout-outs to DJ Mollusk for putting up with us for the last hour.
No problem. Making it on the show.
My turn now, or what?
Yeah. DJ Mollusk, what do you have?
Well, first off, I want to give a shout-out. I don't think anybody's helped this guy out enough. Is Jason Scott of Textiles.com.
Oh, yeah. He's posted.
I don't know if you guys know this, but he does have a mirror of your show on the audio.
Yeah, I remember he went through error PMing me going, holy fucking God, why the hell is he posting our shitty show?
It was, I believe, slash me shits pants.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just messing around on Textiles.com today and just, I don't know, just really impressed with all the work he's put into that. It's like a lot of time he's put into all that.
If you didn't know, there's cd.textiles.com, and he doesn't link to that, but it's actually a part of the site.
Yeah, I think he didn't mention that on RFA 99.
I think he mentioned it on RFA or BinRev, I'm not sure. But it's cd.textiles.com, and it's some cool crap in there.
He is also working on a BBS documentary that I can't wait to see.
Yeah, it's how much is that going to be? It's going to be like $80 or something? It's going to be like 2 DVDs.
Yeah, he just has lots of hours of film to go through.
Yeah, that's something.
He had like 200 interviews and like 248 hours of video.
That's something I'm really waiting for. Sounds real interesting. That's all we have.
All right.
I don't really know what the outro music is going to be because I haven't picked it out yet. So, it's a secret, I guess. Later.
Yeah. Out.
Wait.